Welcome to episode 33 of About Nashville with Mike Rogers. I'm Mike Rogers, and you're probably wondering where we have been, right? Where you at, Rock? Where you at? Well, we've had a lot going on. We'll get more to that later. We'll try to explain to everybody what's going on as much as we possibly can. Today's guest is going to be my dad, my father, Ray Rogers, who is a prominent guy in the boxing world. He's in the Golden Gloves Hall of Fame, the Silver Gloves Hall of Fame, the Arkansas Sports Hall of Fame, the Arkansas Sports Writers Hall of Fame. He's the longest reigning president for both the National Silver Gloves and the National Golden Gloves. He's in both of their Hall of Fames. He's also a world famous legendary cut man for many boxers like Jermaine Taylor and Tommy the Duke Morrison and Hector Macho Camacho and Wayne McCullough, Iran Barkley, and the list goes on and on and on and on. I went to Little Rock over the last month to celebrate my father's 80th birthday. 80th birthday. What?
It's amazing.
I know, it made me feel old. It made him feel old, I'm sure. Wow. But I mean, 80 years old. But yeah, I was like, holy cow, 80 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, getting back to where we had been, we had to take a few weeks off, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. We've got some big things working. The only way to have got them accomplished, I would have had to clone myself two or three times over to have made it. Well, you know, I would be afraid. I would be afraid if there were multiple me's out there in this world. That would be kind of creepy. Could I tell them to go do the bad things that I wouldn't want to do or couldn't do, or
possibly
maybe. All right. Yeah. All right. I'd be afraid. They'd all like get on my wife or something. You know, it'd be like that bad episode of Multiplicity. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Not, but the thought of it to get on your wife.
Yeah, there was this episode of Multiplicity with who was it? Michael Keaton, and they were clones of himself, and all of the various versions were slightly different. And like one was like kind of cocky and arrogant, and one was like real smart, and one was kind of like real stupid and doopy, and they ended up all sleeping with his wife.
That could be fun.
In the same night.
That could be fun.
Don't give her any ideas.
No, it could be. If I could take like parts of guys that I've dated and make them one person, I have the perfect guy. I wouldn't be the cat lady.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, what would you do with Frank and Weenie?
Let him get on me.
Oh gosh.
Frank and Weenie.
it was weird interviewing him. My dad is a really, really funny guy. Like anytime he gets interviewed on television or on the radio or anything like this, he's always got a one-liner. He's very quick, he's very funny, he's very quick-witted. And when I interviewed him, there was none of that. I mean, absolutely none of that. Like, he would not laugh. As a matter of fact, like, some of the questions I could tell were irritating him. Because it was one of those deals where they were rhetorical questions.
Right.
He knew I knew the answer to him.
Right.
And he was getting, kind of agitated that I was asking these questions. So, where were you born?
So, he couldn't separate the two. He's looking like, okay, you're my son. You know the answers to these questions.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It was kind of, but I was trying to, I was waiting for him to drop a joke on me. He didn't.
Did you learn anything about him that you didn't already know?
Yes. He doesn't like me asking him rhetorical questions.
Okay.
So I did a comedy show with Bubba Bradley. We did a sold out show in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Exciting. And
it was fun. Big theater, and it was a comedy show, and it was my last comedy show.
Boo.
Yeah, I'm not going to be doing it anymore.
No, that sucks.
I know.
I mean, because having seen you perform, I mean, you're really good at it.
I can still be a goofball. I just won't be on stage being a goofball.
Okay.
But, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And while I was away, I also did a few other interviews on other shows. I went and did some interviews.
Okay, so this is new to me.
Yeah, yeah. So those will be coming out within the next month or so.
Well, you don't like to share stuff, so we'll be able to hear these interviews?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. What do you mean I don't like to share stuff?
This is my last comedy show. I didn't record it. Nobody will ever be able to see it.
That's right.
So just know that I did it.
That's right. like I made a porn tape and didn't film it.
So just know it's out there.
Just know it's out there, or could have been. What?
Exactly. See,
you didn't film it, and you. How do you call that a porn if it wasn't? Because I was having sex. but you didn't film it, so you can't really prove that you did it. I don't have to prove a damn thing. I know I did it.
You know you did it. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. So that's how that happened. And I may have locked down a super high profile guest for next month.
Uh-oh.
Can't say on here yet.
That's what I'm talking about.
What?
You have these secrets. I can't. Big profile person.
It's a high, very high profile.
Can't say who it is.
Can't. But we're in the process of trying to get them on the show. And it will be huge.
Okay.
I was going to try to do Donald Trump, but I can't remember. How does he say
it? Let's not.
How does he say
that?
Huge?
I don't
huge?
Know.
Huge. Huge. I don't know. I don't want to do Donald Trump.
No, let's
I'd rather
not.
Do Ivanka.
Do it.
Jesus. Stop that. You're being nasty.
Yes.
Let's see here. Halloween. We got Halloween coming up.
We do.
What are you going as?
I don't know. I don't really do Halloween. I did the last Halloween party I did was last year. I was dressed up as a ghost.
You scary as hell.
I was a ghost. Out of all things to be.
Ghost.
I threw a sheet over my head.
So a black woman wearing a white sheet.
Yes.
Think about what I just said.
Well, yes, I did.
A black woman wearing a white
yes.
sheet.
Yes.
You're like a hidden KKK member. That's
right.
What you are.
And I had fun with
you
it.
You ever seen that episode with Dave Chappelle?
Yes, I did. It was hilarious. That's classic.
It's great.
That is classic.
The blind black guy that's a racist. The blind black racist guy.
Yes.
He does not know he's black.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
It's great.
It was a good
one. It was awesome. So that was
way,
me.
Way ahead of its time.
That was me.
So did you play it that way, or did you
no,
just, you were just a ghost?
I did it.
Oh, my gosh. The Walking Dead. So first of all, my wife and I are going to a Halloween party. And I don't know, do you ever watch Saturday Night Live?
Yes.
We're going as Ariana and Craig, the cheerleaders, Will Ferrell.
Yes. Yes. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we're going. I even got a little curly wig. To
so
it.
Are you going to hide that? Are we going to be able to see that?
No. I'm not going to see this. I might put a picture up. Who knows? My wife might not let me.
Blur her face out.
She won't. I don't know. She didn't go.
We want to see you. Jennifer's pretty. She's pretty anyway. So we want to see you.
We'll see. We'll talk
with
about
this
it.
Curly
I don't know.
Wig.
Who knows? Yeah, I'm gonna wear a curly wig. I might even wear it. No, I'm not gonna do that. Anyway, so the Walking Dead TV series premiered Sunday night, and it went down exactly. As I predicted.
Stop predicting. You ruined it.
Literally, it went exactly as I predicted. I told my wife. Actually, I told. I finally came to the conclusion as to what I thought was going to go down about a month ago, and I told. I told a couple friends, and they were like, "Yeah, that sounds like it could possibly happen." And then I made the prediction online like a few hours before the episode premiered. And then when it happened, I was like, oh, my gosh, I better pull this down. People are going to think I put up a spoiler.
You did.
Because it was very, very, I mean, it was very close.
You ruined it.
Yeah,
stop
it was,
doing that.
It was very close.
Keep those kind of things to yourself. You do that with other stuff.
Well, I can't help it that I can foresee things.
It's
I
like,
mean,
keep it to yourself.
No, it's not. If it's a prediction, it's not like
ruin it for us. For
how
our,
am I ruining
us.
It for somebody if I'm predicting? If I'm making a prediction, I'm not putting out a spoiler.
But your
I don't
predictions.
Actually know.
Become spoilers.
Most of them.
Yes, yeah, see?
But I can't help that.
Okay.
Okay. I get what you're saying. Whatever.
Thank you.
it was a good episode though. Oh my gosh. What is his name? Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Man, playing Negan. He is just intense. He is an intense dude on this on the show. So let's talk about some national news.
What's going on?
Because we've got all kinds of crazy stuff going on. Are you keeping up with this WikiLeaks thing with Julian Assange and all that? What are you following anything?
No, I'm not. I hear it from time to time.
So here's the thing. This is what I can't get my head around. There is some blatant corruption going on here. And, it's like all out there for everybody to see in the emails.
Right.
And then so the DNC, as opposed to saying whatever, they go, what's the Russians?
Right.
I'm like,
right.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably very plausible, but it doesn't discount the fact that these things were really done or said.
It's kind of a diversion.
No, I don't know. I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I'll use this for an example. Like Donna Brazile, there was for Congress inside the investigation, she was actually, by Hillary's team, was given a question to ask Hillary in the investigation.
Okay.
And she said it verbatim. And they had it there. And then she was like, "Why well, that you don't know, that's a stolen email. You don't even know if it's real or not."
It's
you
a
don't
stolen email.
So but then they had some techie guys that are way far smarter than me that ran it through this some kind of a quick check thing or whatever else, and then within 5 minutes they verified, yeah, this was 100% real email. I was like, "Yeah,
really?
this really happened." It's like, "Oh my gosh." And then there was another email that came out, and it was like so we need everybody to, when you do your polls, get a larger than normal demographic sample and put that out there to the polls to make it look like
right.
And I'm like, holy cow, what? Wait, what? I don't know. That was just one of many things. There was like a ton of things that are coming out, and you're going, holy wow.
So you stay on top of this WikiLeaks thing.
I do.
You do.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And the reason I stay on top of it, because the media is not reporting it. They're just like staying away from it. They consider it. They're just not reporting it.
But it comes up from time to time. From time to time.
Well, like, there's no one that can really strategically bring it up in the. And I'll use this for an example, like the debates. It's watching the debates was like watching Floyd Mayweather box a street fighter, you know,
right.
a barroom street brawler.
Right.
You know, you have this person that is trained how to divert and how to deflect and how to pivot.
Yes.
And you know, you got this other guy that it just knows how to fight from the streets,
right.
and they're just throwing wild haymakers.
Right.
And, you know, so my point being is, he did not know how to deliver any of these messages to make them effective. He just kind of threw stuff out there. And she just strategically like boom, 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 boom.
But you know what I think?
Punched it, countered it. Pow.
I think he did enough for people to actually get it and research it. That's if we're going to research it. He did throw WikiLeaks out there.
Yeah.
He threw. I mean, a lot of this stuff people
yeah,
haven't
true.
Heard of before.
Really?
So,
you think? Even all
yeah.
the. Golly,
yeah.
it's yeah. crazy.
So, yeah. So, I think he did enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really up to, you know, his audience to actually pick up and do their own research about it.
I don't think that in my personal opinion, I don't think that he's skilled enough to have delivered the message the way he should have or properly. You know, in my personal opinion, she knew how to execute and strike deliberately to divert. And,
she does.
And he just, like, responds. He all he does is defend and react.
He does
defend and react. All you gotta do is mention something to him. Groping women, and he's like, I
yeah.
don't what
they're lying.
Yeah, they're lying. Wrong.
I'm suing these women
Wrong.
When this is over.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah, he does.
And I'm like, oh my gosh.
But you have to realize, I think the average American understands that. I really do.
What?
I think so.
Now, that's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot all about that. All these women that are coming out of the woodworks right now.
Oh, yes.
So, have you, this is what made me laugh. So, this one woman says, yeah, he grabbed me or tried to kiss me or whatever else. And then the day before, she had just launched her own little sex toy shop.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It wasn't me, was it?
No. No. trying to use the publicity to drive,
right,
you know.
Right.
I don't know. This is where I go with all that. And this is where I kind of get frustrated with it. People are like, well, you just don't understand that if they were assaulted, if this was really happening, then they probably, they're finding their voice and their strength and doing it now. I'm calling BS on two parts. It's not that he's just a billionaire, because any woman that's going to feel that way is going to sue your
oh yeah
top, I
oh,
mean
yeah.
you know
yeah
so that's number one. So but even to take that out of the perspective, even to take that out of the equation, why didn't this come up in the primaries?
That's a good question.
Why didn't this come up in the primaries?
And a lot of times, you do have those women that are, that are placed in certain positions to ask and do certain things when you get to a certain level. And that may be the case.
Hillary Clinton in emails.
There you go.
So do you already know what I'm saying?
There you go.
Say, in the WikiLeaks emails, she's been sitting on all of this for months.
I didn't know that, but.
Months.
But that, I mean.
And here's the thing is she had dirt on Rubio, on Cruz.
Really?
Yeah. She had like all these emails with like. She was stockpiling all the dirt on everybody.
That's my girl.
Because I was like, oh my gosh. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
So I don't know how this election's going to turn out. I'm almost to the point that I almost don't care.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that, but I'm almost feeling that way as well.
I mean, we got an election day coming up, 1st of November. I wouldn't say I wouldn't care. That's not the right. I just feel helpless.
And hopeless.
Helpless and hopeless. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It just feels like one of those kind of like.
Damned if you do, damned
yeah,
if you
yeah.
don't.
Give me a bullet. One of them's gonna kill me.
Right.
They're neither one of them's any prettier than the other.
That's right. And I know. That's right.
You know, and I've said this even since the beginning. You know, of the election, I'm like, it's like choosing between the two different bullets that's gonna take us out.
Oh
know?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Really?
But it's entertaining to watch.
I tell you, it was until she started talking about late term abortions. I was like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me?
Yeah, she... Yeah.
So that part, I was like, okay, you just said you wanted to say... Oh, so you want to save the toddlers from guns, but yet you want to kill them while
right, before they even get here.
So, right.
Yeah.
Like, do you know how that works? The baby's legs are kicking and everything else, and they pull it halfway out, and then they stick it in there, and they cut its neck, and then drive something through its head? That's murder.
We kind of.
That's not abortion.
That.
That's murder.
It is. I agree.
I mean,
I mean, I also agree with allowing a woman to make.
And do you know how many cases where women have had to do that to save their own lives?
None. That's just a touchy.
It's never happened.
Well, I mean, a lot of women who go through certain situations and they actually die giving birth. You don't know that you're going to die.
Either way. The birth of the baby. If you're in the middle of labor, and you're giving birth, killing that baby isn't gonna save you.
See, I don't know how that all works. I really don't. But there have been women who have died giving birth.
100%. Yes, but killing the baby is not going to save you.
Not killing the baby. You keep saying killing the baby.
It's your
stopping the labor. Depending on how it's done.
No, that's murder. At that point, that's murder. That's murder.
Okay.
No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And once, really, I mean, to be 100% honest, I mean, there has to be some kind of parameter around it.
And there should.
I mean.
And there should. I agree.
I mean.
I agree.
Obviously, if the mother's life is at risk in some way or another.
Right.
And there, maybe there is, I don't know. I don't know what that decision would be or how they would do that, but.
But needless to say, that's not Hillary Clinton's goal. That's not what she.
No. No. Her whole thing is late-term abortion.
That's an abortion. Not saying that if it's in the, you have to decide whether to save the mother or the child.
Right.
That's not what she's doing.
Well, and the problem is it puts people in a position to use abortion as contraceptive or birth control, and I completely and I'm utterly against that one. And that has nothing to do with my religious beliefs.
Right.
I agree at some certain point there should be a cutoff, and it should be unless there's the health of the baby or the health of the mother to take into consideration, then you should not be able to move forward with that. Now, that's obviously not what Roe versus Wade states. But Roe versus Wade is based off of antiquated science.
Okay.
So I'll put this in perspective. So Roe versus Wade happened in the early 70s.
Okay.
I believe. It was the late 60s, early 70s. And back then, we didn't have the same kind of medical technology that we have today.
I agree.
And we didn't realize how soon a child felt things or how soon they were actually a child, even while they were. So Roe versus Wade was based off of antiquated science.
Right.
And I think that it needs to be overturned, and they need to go back and revisit it.
I'm sure it's been revisited, but
no, there's been no amendments to Roe versus Wade.
Well, no, not to say there hasn't been any amendments to it, but they know now more than they
but
knew
they
then.
Won't
but, on,
that they won't, but
they
won't
probably
reverse
won't.
It. They
they
won't
probably
reverse
won't.
It.
But they know better now.
But the doesn't change anything.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, what if you had a law that stated you could, you know, take your kid out up to 2 years of age?
I don't think I would like that law. I don't think I would like that. I kind of like my kid at 2 years old.
I don't know. It is all of this is a very touchy.
It's a very touchy subject,
and you know, we're just kind of discussing it and trying to throw our own two cents into it. But you know, the truth of the matter is, we'll never understand the depth of it all. And you know, we're just kind of, you know, it's just. It's a
very true,
you know, and she, I don't know. I struggle with all that. Now that is the only thing that I can actually say that he said that I was actually for.
Yeah.
It was taking care of the children. And that was like, okay.
I mean, he really didn't say a lot of anything else.
No, wrong, wrong, wrong.
We know that.
Wrong. So. Not true. Lie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So yeah, and another thing that came out in the whole. Now you remember all the. And she cringed when he said this. There's two things that was huge in the WikiLeaks. One was the whole pay for play was proven in the WikiLeaks thing, where she was taking money into the Clinton Foundation and then giving favors from her office and Secretary of State.
Okay.
That was proven in the WikiLeaks. And I was like, oh my gosh. Because he confronted her on it, and she didn't say nothing about it. She just pivoted off and went to something else.
Yeah, she always gets this weird look on her face when he kind of throws something out there that she's not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, yeah, she lying.
But what about this one? So she, I'm like, you dummy. He just called you out on that, and then you just threw that out. She says, you incite violence. You incite violence at your own rallies, blah, 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 blah. Well, did you?
Yeah.
I'm like, you big dummy. Are you reading any of these WikiLeaks?
You big dummy.
I'm like, you big dummy. Are you reading any of these WikiLeaks? So it was them.
Yeah.
The DNC is the one that was paying all these people to go to the Trump rallies and start the riots.
Yes.
I'm like.
And she always says, allegedly.
Allegedly, hell.
No, that's what she says about WikiLeaks.
A WikiLeaks, there's nothing alleged. There's nothing alleged.
She said that stuff is. I'm just saying what I've heard her say.
So is it allegedly the Russians?
Allegedly.
No.
Allegedly.
She's 100% convinced on that one.
She wouldn't say that. She wouldn't.
She said the Russians want Trump to win, and actually, that is probably very true. You know why they're pissed off at her, don't you?
No.
Well, because Obama and Hillary armed the ISIS Muslims in Syria versus the Russians, and they're pissed at them. Yeah. They're like, really? You're going to give them guns and to fight us, and you want us to help you? No.
Not going to happen, right?
Not going to happen. So, I don't know. We got off on a wave on a political tangent.
That's okay.
You know, there's some crazy stuff going on in this world.
We have to catch up on.
Right. We've been gone for a month. And we're talking about all this crazy stuff. People are like, would you shut up about this damn politics?
Wiki-kiki
leaks and...
Wrong.
Wrong. Lie. Wrong. Oh my gosh, Alec Baldwin is hilarious playing him on Saturday Night Live.
Oh my goodness, wasn't that funny?
He is hilarious.
It was so funny.
It's spot on. It's spot on.
I like DVR'd it and I watched it like 30 times. He is so funny.
Spot on.
Especially when he was stalking her. He was just like, and then that creepy noise would come behind her. It was just funny.
Yeah.
It was funny.
I would agree. He did a fantastic job on that one.
He did awesome.
Did you hear about the concert we had here in Nashville Monday night?
Concert.
Uh-huh. With Garth Brooks.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go?
I did not. I didn't even know because I didn't know about it.
But you asked me if I knew.
Well, I found out about it later. I think I actually heard about it, but I didn't. I thought you had to have tickets because, you know, usually when...
Was it a free concert?
It was a free concert.
What?
It was a free concert. He did it at the Ascend Amphitheater, and he was celebrating. Now, this part's going to, like, flip you out. He's put out 11 studio albums. He's got the 11th one is coming out. Okay, so he's putting out a box set that will come out November the 11th.
Okay.
And then in the box set, it will include the new album, which is called Gunslinger.
Okay.
And then Gunslinger will actually hit the market as an individual album on November 25th, I believe. And it was amazing because they were celebrating seven diamonds.
Okay.
And what that means is seven out of his 11 albums released have gone. Well, really only 10, 7 out of 10, because he hasn't released this 11th one yet. But so 7 out of 10 have gone diamond. You know what that means?
That is amazing.
You know what that means?
Yeah, that's like over so many million. I mean, I can't remember how many.
10 million
wow.
a piece.
Wow. That's amazing.
So just to put that in perspective.
Wow.
The Beatles have only had 6 albums go diamond.
Wow.
And he has sold more albums than any other artist in any other genre in the entire history of music.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, when I was growing up, I loved Merle Haggard. I loved Dwight Yoakam. I loved Your Real Country. I loved Randy Travis. And then, you know, I was watching Garth. You know, I was like, hey, you know, this is kind of cool. This guy, he's like a rock and roll performer, but he sings country music.
Yeah,
and
I was my
like,
dad listened to Garth.
Like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So he went out there and he had a huge show. They had over 6,800 people at the amphitheater.
And nobody knew about it. And 6,800 people showed up.
Right?
Wow.
That's the strength of Garth. That guy's Garth Gantuan.
That's amazing.
But yeah, he had all kinds of artists that were out there with him. He had Jason Aldean, Chris Young, Reba McEntire, Kelly Clarkson, his wife Trisha Yearwood, and they all sang with him.
And nobody knew about this concert?
They all sang with him. Yeah, they knew about it, but I don't...
6,800 people?
I said they knew about it. I didn't know whether it was free or not. I didn't know that.
Wow.
And then Randy Travis was actually there, even in attendance.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you saw the video online or anything, but he was singing Megan. Well, he had a stroke. I don't know if you know that or not, but he had a stroke, and he was with Garth, as a matter of fact, and he was singing "Amazing Grace" someplace, and it was very heartwarming. That man, he inspired me greatly.
Did he really?
Yeah, absolutely. Randy Travis, big time. You know,
hit it, "Amazing Grace." Now, you're on the spot. "Amazing Grace," go.
Wrong. Wrong.
Okay.
Lie.
Okay.
Wrong.
There was your opportunity.
Wrong.
To take us to church.
Wrong.
Okay.
WikiLeaks. I heard on WikiLeaks that I wasn't going to be singing Amazing Grace.
That is probably the truest thing on WikiLeaks.
No, everything's true on WikiLeaks because I told you how they check
okay,
it, right?
Okay, we're not going back to WikiLeaks.
You the one bringing up WikiLeaks.
I know, I'm sorry.
So. So, you voted yet?
Yeah, I did.
Good deal.
I did.
Good deal. Everybody needs to go out there and vote. I don't care who you vote for. Just go out there and vote and do your...
There was a blank space at the bottom.
American duty. There was somebody.
And I put your name there. For president.
That is funny.
I did.
Mike Rogers got a vote president of the United States of America.
Yeah, there were so many different people, and then they had a spot right there just for you.
And oh, goodness gracious, that's scary. I would never want to be president.
Well, you know what? You're on my ballot.
It's wrong. All right, let's get on to this interview with my dad, Ray Rogers. Let's do this thing.
Cause I'm a knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman. A knockout fighter with a kick-ass band. That's why they call me the Honky Tonk Hitman. Yeah.
Welcome to About Nashville with your host, the Honky Tonk Hitman, Mike Rogers.
Hey.
I had Jerry Don Starkey, Jimmy Dean Anthony, and my little brother David, and they wanted to go to the special weights, which is same as Junior Olympics or Junior Golden Gloves now, but they were special weights, and the weights ran from 50 pounds up to 105, and I took the three of them up there. They first told me that I couldn't enter them because I was too young to coach.
How old were you?
16.
You were 16 years old when you were coaching?
All yes.
Right. So, okay, so they told you too young.
And they asked me, I told them that I was going to enter these boys, and they said, wait, you're not old enough to coach. So I said, well, show me in the rule book where it says that you got to have a certain age to be able to coach. And they kind of had a little huddle, and they said, well, we're going to let you enter them, but we're going to keep a close eye on you. Well, that was my launching in coaching, and I've been coaching ever since.
So they couldn't, they were going to try to shut you down, but then when you pulled them out on the whole rule thing, they...
I did. That's exactly what happened. And I still, the guy that was the chairman, Jerry Kerwin, that owned Kerwin Sporting Goods in Fort Smith, he's 93 years old, and we still correspond regularly.
Where did you train them at?
I trained them all over Conway. At the VFW, had an empty building next to their beer joint, and we used that for a while. Then we used a burned-out shell of an old building where Verco Manufacturing Company used to be, and we would work out at the school gym unbeknownst to the school sometimes. So, but we made do.
Did you have any funding or anything? I mean,
No.
Where'd you get the equipment?
I bought it.
Were you working?
Yes, I worked at Fronthall and Schwartz when I was 14 years old, making $14.20 for 5.5 days a week.
Oh, wow. And then you would take that money and you would invest it in equipment and keep the boys coaching.
Yep.
Coach or start coaching the boys. And you did that, and you started the whole thing going. How long did you stay in Conway coaching?
Till 1961.
Okay. And then you moved to Little Rock?
Moved to Little Rock. Yep.
Okay. Is that after you graduated college?
Yep. Graduated August the 7th, 1960.
Okay. And then you went to Little Rock, Arkansas because of work?
Yep.
Okay, and how did work take to your coaching, and or did it ever get in the way?
No, not really. And I was coaching on the side, and also judged and refereed for Buddy Holderfield, who's a boxing legend, basically in Arkansas, and we were good friends. I first met him in 1950. In Conway at a boxing show at the Armory, and we remained lifelong friends. And Buddy was a very knowledgeable boxing guy.
He coached me for a year and a half.
A little erratic, but he was still a good coach and a good guy. But then after that, I opened my own gym in the early 70s and took guys everywhere, and been doing that around the Little Rock area. I've been at Junior Deputy Sports Complex since 1987, so whatever that is.
19 years.
It's a little longer than 19
29 years.
Yeah, I'll try that.
29 years.
And I guess I'm there to stay, so.
I'll leave the math out of it. where were you coaching them in the early 60s? You still boxed until like 62?
Yeah, that was about the end of my career, and I had coached at the Little Rock Boys Club, North Little Rock Boys Club. I was a kind of a meandering coach that wherever I could get in and get the kids, that's where I was.
Okay, and then, so you didn't have a set place.
Did not have a home, no.
So where was your first home? Was that the one that I remember in Conway at that grocery store?
No, it was, it was an old closed grocery warehouse. P. Plunkett and Gerald, I think was the name of it, or M&K Grocers. But
that was like 74?
That was, yeah, 74. And if you load, I'd load up my car with kids and take them to Conway and get there about 6 o'clock every day and get them all back home around 10 or 10:30. Did that for a couple of years. And then I went to Rose City. I went from Rose City to North Heights. And then I went to Hogan's
Gym. Yeah, when did Hogan's come into play?
Well, Hogan's came in. You remember I was upstairs at the Downtown Athletic Club.
I do. I do remember that. We had boxing matches there.
Yep. That was in... all these years start to run together, but... probably, I don't know, 74, 75, 76, somewhere along in there. And because I remember I had the first tournament at Barton Coliseum in 1977. That's when I had Clint Jackson and Michael McCallum and Jackie Beard. I had a great tournament over there. And
all those boxers from Jackson, except for McCallum. Were, where was McCallum from, Knoxville?
Actually, it was from Haiti, but he boxed at that time for Knoxville, and so did Clinton Jackson. And they had right here in Nashville, they had a sheriff at that time named Fate Thomas. And Fate brought all these kids in from all around. He made them jailers and deputy sheriffs and all that, but they were... ostensibly they were here to work, but they were really on his boxing team, and they had a powerhouse. That was around 1978 or 79, and as they say on television, look it up.
All right. Well, I remember what I remember the most about being at that Hogan's facility, and also at the facility that was up above, because it was on top of it.
Yeah, you had to take the elevator to get there.
Right, and I remember in the mid '70s, we would have boxing matches up there with Harold Britton, all those guys. Norman Evans
and Antoine
Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt,
yeah,
all those guys. Joe Presley,
Jerry Agnew. And the gym that was below that, Hogan's.
That came 5 years later. I went from Downtown Athletic Club. They went bankrupt, so I moved to Rose City Boys and Girls Club. And then Gary Hogan got a hold of me and said, let's build a gym downtown. I said, and I had one of the highest profile gyms anywhere, because it was at the corner of East Markham and Cumberland, which everybody coming off the freeway had to see it. And we had great big picture windows, if you remember. And so anybody could drive by and see it.
It was very old school looking, yeah.
Yeah, and it stoked a lot of interest in amateur boxing to realize that, hey, right here in downtown Little Rock, we've got a great boxing club. And then we went from Hogan's to North Heights. And then from North Heights, we went to Grandview, which we moved out of. It was a fortuitous thing because their boy was stabbed and killed in the lobby of the Grandview. And then the thing that finally, one night we were working out and a woman chased a guy across the, they run in the front door and across the gym and out the back door, and she was waving a pistol at it. And I told the kids we weren't going to be back there. And as God would have it, I was home sitting in my recliner that very same night, and Jerry Agnew with the sheriff's department said, we've got a empty building down at Junior Deputy, which was actually run by the sheriff's department at that time. And they asked me if I'd be interested. And I said, yes, I'd be very interested. So I brought all the stuff out of storage that I had from Hogan's gym, and we built the Golden Gloves gym at Junior Deputy, and I've been there since 1988, something, 87, 88, somewhere along in there. So
okay,
that brings me right up to date.
Right up to date. So another thing that I remember, when we first started boxing, we were part of the AAU program. This was in the 70s. And when I first started, we didn't wear headgears. We didn't wear tank tops. You know, there was no such thing as a standing eight count. It was just like a three-round pro bout. And that was where you started dabbling in cut medicine.
That's correct.
So, because, you know, with all this ridiculousness of amateur boxing, talking about taking off the headgears and everything now, I think, you know, from people that had been back there in that world and know exactly how treacherous it can be, they don't realize that they're opening up a can of worms. So let's talk about that can of worms, and let's go back there, because that's actually how you got your skill set. Tell me about how you started learning cut medicine and why you started learning and who you learned it from.
Well, like every other cut man, you learn by doing. And you watch, you learn, you practice. It's just something that I remember. There was a couple of instances back in the late 70s when a boy got cut down at Pine Bluff, and they knew that I was pretty well schooled in that, and they asked me to fix his face, and I did. And then a year or two after that, a little boy down, you got to realize there weren't any headgears. And
what year was this, Pop?
Late 70s. And this kid got his ear torn at the top, and I pasted it back. I glued it back on, actually.
That was in Hot Springs, wasn't it?
It was in Hot Springs. And I saw the little boy. He's now 40-something. And he said, "Well, you did a good job, Coach." He said, "My ear's still here." So,
he said, "Huh?"
Pretty much. But, and anyway, and then, and of course, you know, a lot of those guys, Ace Marotta, Biff Holstein, guys like that, I was a young, upcoming, fledgling little cut man, and they all liked me, and they knew I'd been around a long time, a long, long time, and they kind of took me under their wing. And so you just, it's something that, like a surgeon, I guess, you get better every time you do it. And at this point, I've worked close to 50 world championship bouts. I worked with Macho Camacho, Iran Barkley, Tommy Morrison, Wayne McCullough, Phil Jackson, and on and on and on. But it's something that you got to have a steady hand. You got to know what you got to do. You got 50 seconds or less to take care of a boxer. And that's why when you're successful, success breeds success, and these guys will call you.
Well, you said something interesting, because you know, a lot of people out there won't understand this, but old school cut men, it's a very cliquish, you know, very you know, kind of, they're very the fact that they took you in was incredible, because you almost have to be born into it, if you will, because
yeah, well, they're very cliquish. There's no question about that, and like Biff used to say, if they don't like you, they won't give you the time of day.
Right.
And if they do like you, they will. Percy Richardson, a guy that, and most of these guys, like myself, came up through amateur boxing, Golden Gloves in particular. And at that time, we had, you know, it was not against the rules to be able to work on a amateur between rounds, just like you do in the pros. If you could stop it, well, you stopped it. So, and I became very, very proficient at it. So,
and gave you the skill set to do that.
Yep.
So, you have worked with a lot of great professionals. So, what opened that door for you in the professional arena to start going from transitioning from being an amateur cut man to actually being a professional cut man? And
I was never an amateur cut man. I was always good from the start.
Really?
Well, I worked in the amateurs, but I wasn't an amateur cut man.
I get it, and I get what you're saying.
You took to it naturally, and they saw me work in the Nationals. Virtually every coach that went on, from Emmanuel Stewart on up and down, came through the Golden Gloves program. Matter of fact, Emmanuel Stewart was a national Golden Glove champion. A lot of people don't know that. Back about 112, 118 pounds back in 1963.
I didn't know that.
And so they all know you, and they all we were kind of cliquish after, and these guys, we'd all huddle and sit and talk and so on, and what's the latest ointment or whatever that's come out, what are you using now, and how do you do, I mean, we'd exchange ideas just like a bunch of professors. Matter of fact, Biff Holstein always called me the professor because I was on the cutting edge. I stayed on top of all that stuff, but I really broke into professional boxing in the mid 80s, I guess, when a guy in Memphis called me, wanted me to be the what they call that, house cut man. They had about four or five boxers that didn't have a corner man or a cut man, and I just went over to Memphis, and it was at the Mid-South Coliseum, and I worked four or five bouts that night out of a 10-card show, and the guy said, well, I'll mail you a check. I said, no, I'll wait. He said, well, I'm real busy. I said, well, I got time to wait. And I got my check, and I cashed it the next morning as fast as I could because I figured it was hot as a $2 pistol, but it wasn't. It didn't bounce, or the other guy's checks probably bounced. But he said, I'll use you every. Well, that's the end of that show.
You got paid, and he didn't want to use you anymore.
No, he never did. He was going to have a show every month. He never had another show, period. I don't know whatever happened to him.
But it wasn't Red, was it?
No. This guy, I think he was a mob guy. His name was Jimmy D'Angelo or somebody like that. He had one of those kind of names that made you suspicious. And
And then it went from that to Tommy. Let's talk about Tommy Morrison, because if I remember correctly, didn't that all start in Knoxville whenever he was an amateur in the National Guard?
No, it started in Omaha in 1988.
Okay.
And, 88. And he got an eye boogered up, and they brought him to me and said, Ray, I understand you can fix this. And I fixed it for him, and he lost in the finals, but it wasn't because of that. And they brought me another boy from Florida who went on to become, I can't think of his name, had a Spanish sounding name, but he had a cut on his forehead, and I took care of that for him. But they knew who to bring these kids to get them fixed up. But Tommy's dad said, well, when he turns pro, we will use you as a cut man. Well, I've heard that probably 1,000 times, and I haven't had a 1,000 guys to work with. But anyway, they did, in fact, and I was in Tommy's corner from virtually from the time he turned pro until he developed AIDS, and he was going to Japan, and it's after they told me or told him that he had AIDS, and so I refused to go. I said, Tommy, I'm working with a bunch of kids in my gym, and if I go with you, these families will probably take their kid out of boxing because they think that I might be exposed to that, so I can't go. And he said, Ray, I understand. So we were friends. So they asked me to speak at his funeral, as a matter of fact. So, but it's been a good ride. I was in his corner actually the night we fought and beat George Foreman in 1993, June of 93, I believe it was. And then when George came to Little Rock on a book tour, and I bought one of his books, and I stood in line for him to sign it for him. I said, "George, you know, I was the cut man in the other corner." He said, "Ray, I could have used you that night." Because his eyes, if you notice, if you go back and watch the replay, at the minute the bout was over, he put his sunglasses on in the ring because both his eyes were swollen. And they did a poor job in his corner, but that's neither here nor there.
Would you say that was Tommy's biggest victory?
Well, yeah, as far as notoriety, probably so. Probably so. And his worst loss was Michael Bent.
I remember that.
That cost him seven. He had a contract for $7 million to box somebody in Vegas, but he had to still have that undefeated record. Well, that went out the window in about a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it was.
So, if I'm not mistaken, he had just signed a contract with Don King or somebody to fight Mike Tyson.
That's what the $7 million contract was.
Oh, no, that was Lennox Lewis. That one was Lennox Lewis.
You know, like I said, I've never really gotten into the mechanics of all of their contracts and all that kind of stuff because I'm a hired gun. And they call me, I show up. Being a cut man, I've gone to Hong Kong, Glasgow, Belfast, London, Dusseldorf, Berlin, you name it. And I've been in probably every state in the nation that had boxing. So
That was what happened. He had signed a contract to do like two or three fights, and he was going to fight Tyson. And then it was that first fight that he was going to fight that they found out he was HIV positive. And
we were in Vegas. We were going to box a guy named Stormy Weathers.
you didn't miss me.
No, I didn't make it up. That his last name was Weathers. It was that was really his name. And when I got a phone call, and it was his trainer, Tommy Vergess. He said, "Ray, we need to talk to you." And I said, "What about?" And he said, "Well, we're coming. Come, what room are you in?" I told them, and they came up to the room, and when I opened the door, they both were white as a sheet. And I said, "What's the matter, guys?" I said, "Well, Tommy tested positive." And I said, "What kind of drugs was it?" He said, "No, he tested positive for HIV. And I said, "Well, where is he?" And I said, they told me, he said, "He's on the plane on the way back home." So, and that was true. He was gone. The minute they found out he tested positive, they put him back on a plane for Tulsa.
How long was it after that he had that? I remember him having a conference, I guess.
Real quick, probably the next week he had a conference deal.
Yeah, that was terrible. He was actually, if I'm not mistaken, when we fought at Alltel, he was there in the corner and just came up to you and said, "Seems like old times."
Well, you know, I was the only person that Tommy didn't have Stormy tumultuous. He liked the funny stuff I always said to him. I kept him loose, and we had a good friendship, and he was a good guy to work for. Always paid on time and paid me what I was due, and he was always glad to see me. And his relationship with some of the other management people was not so good.
Boy, he had a dynamite left hook.
Yep.
What was the toughest fight you ever had working for him?
Ray Mercer. I can tell you.
Was it Mercer or Hip?
Well, it was, well, now, it depends on how you look at it.
I mean, not necessarily his toughest job, but your toughest job in the corner, keeping him in the fight.
Probably Joe Hip. Probably Joe Hip, because he had a cut under the left eye and over the one over the right eye took 22 stitches after the bout. But the incredible part of that fight was that Tommy had a broken jaw. He had a broken, besides the two cuts, had a broken jaw and a broken thumb. And he still knocked Joe Hip out in the ninth round.
With a broken hand.
Yep.
The guy, one thing.
Incredible.
Absolutely.
Incredible. That's when my admiration for his courage ratcheted right up.
You know, obviously everybody gets better and they, you know, they as time goes on, they whatever, but he really did have a dynamite punch, and he had an absolute, he was just tough as all get out. I mean, he was a tough guy.
He was a tough kid, there's no question about it.
So your other big guy that you worked with throughout your career was Jermaine Taylor. And tell me about how you met Jermaine.
I met him in let's see. He started boxing about 91. He was just a kid, 14, 15 years old. And he told me then, he said, Ray, when I turn pro, of course, that was CA long-term plans, because he was long, he hadn't even been to the Olympics or anything else. He said, when I turn pro, I want you to be my cut man. Well, you can imagine how many times I've heard that.
Right.
And he's never had a bout, championship or otherwise, as a pro that I wasn't in his corner. I'm the only person that has been in his corner every bout he's had. He's had several different trainers and managers, etc., different people in the corner, but I am the one individual that's been in his corner in every bout.
And you know, the I'll tell you a funny story that you may not even know, but even before he went to the Olympics or won the National Golden Gloves or any of that stuff, he and I worked together. He was washing. We worked at Murray's Dinner Theater. I was acting in a show there, and he was washing dishes. And between scenes, we would go back there, and I didn't know it, but he was a country music fan. And we would sit back there singing country music songs together while he was washing dishes. I would crack
up.
Yeah,
he was a big country music fan, as far as I know, still is.
Absolutely. He loves Tim McGraw. He loves Tim McGraw. So let's talk about, there's one particular fight that I really want to talk about with Jermaine, and then I'll let you go. But the one thing I want to talk about is the fight that made his career, and also might have been one of your hardest fights to ever work, besides the Iran Barkley fight, which I think, what did you say, had
62 stitches,
and you kept him in that fight. He went the distance, but in this particular fight there was a whole lot more on the line. He was fighting Bernard Hopkins for the middleweight championship of the world. Bernard will go down as an all-time great, as a Hall of Fame fighter. He will go down as one of the best middleweight champions of all time. And he was the longest reigning middleweight champion of the world, and defending it to the young tiger, Jermaine Bad Intentions Taylor. And you were in his corner, and he was cut terribly.
He was cut on top of his head at 28 seconds, as I recall, deep into the... It was a 12-round championship bout, and the cut occurred from a butt on the top of his head, and at the end of the bout, it took 16 stitches to close it. But, and I came home, I replayed it on the television, watched it again, and the announcer said, well, I can tell you one thing, that cut will be a big factor in the outcome of this bout. As I recall, he never mentioned it again. After he came back to the corner and I passed him up, I had to work hard to keep him in the bout, but we won a split decision, which Bernard, well, he's a big crybaby. Anyway, he's a tough boy, awfully tough, but he was whining about this, that, and the other. Well, that was in July of 2005. In December of 2006, we beat him again. So it was the incredible part. He had not lost in 10 or 12 years to anybody, defended the title about 20 times. And then when we beat him the second time, it wasn't even a split decision. It was a clear majority, like 115 to 112 about three times or something. So I don't know that that ever shut him up. But anyway, we not only beat him once, we beat him twice in the same year, and that was incredible.
And the only person ever in history to ever beat him twice.
That's, yes, that's correct. Most people didn't beat him once.
That's true, very true. You know, and then, you know, and I'll just finish because we're wrapping this up, but, you know, the things that you've accomplished in the sport of professional boxing and amateur boxing is incredible. You're in the National Silver Gloves Hall of Fame. You're in the National Golden Gloves Hall of Fame. You're the National Silver Gloves president. You're the longest reigning National Golden Gloves president. The things that you do for amateur boxing and for kids and for the sport of boxing is just incredible. And the fact that you've been doing it for, you know, 70 years is absolutely incredible. You are an
You left out Arkansas Sports Hall of Fame.
On the Arkansas Sports Hall of Fame. And you're in the Rogers Family Hall of Fame. And you're in the... I don't know where I pulled that one from. But... you know, the things that you've accomplished, it's you know, in 70 years is a lot to be proud of. So,
well, you're saying it like it had a note of finality. I don't intend to quit.
No, not at all.
I don't intend to quit.
All I'm trying to do is...
I'm here for the duration.
Oh, and I know that you are. You will be here as long as people are boxing, and I don't believe the sport's going away. All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.